Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, the supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and, well, if you're calling from out across America, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. We're here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us tonight, back from in Virginia there, and where it's getting pretty late and pretty cold, I suspect, but Larry Pratt of Gun Owners of America. Hi, Larry. How are you doing tonight?
Hey, it's good to be with you, Stan.
Well, let's see. Now, of course, what's happening as far as gun legislation is concerned? How did we do last year? How are we doing now, and what's going to be happening this coming year?
The Congress that we had was very much of a pro-gun Congress in the House. The Senate was very much a mixed bag. Hopefully it was Senator Dianne Feinstein's last real opportunity to put her renewal of her gun ban that she'd gotten through under President Clinton, to put it on some kind of other legislation and get it through as an amendment. She failed even in this Congress, and it looks as if the elections are going to bring us a Congress where it's even less likely that she would be able to succeed. That was a long fight. We had to fight that on two different occasions, back in March and then in June. And happily, the Republicans, and particularly Senator Frist, the majority leader, got better at using the rules that are at his disposal to block the kind of shenanigans that Senator Feinstein was up to. Also, Senator McCain was interested in putting gun shows out of business. He had an amendment up on a bill. He was defeated. So, defensively, we did fine. In the House of Representatives, we actually saw a bill passed with a pretty good majority to overturn the gun ban in the District of Columbia. Congress has constitutional authority for legislation in the District of Columbia. This is a bill that the Congress has, to a shame, allowed to be on the books for almost 30 years now. And the only thing that's brought to the District of Columbia is the distinction of being the murder capital of the jurisdictions of our country. Almost every year, it's the most violent, the most dangerous place that one can be in the United States of America. At least they've done one good thing for us. They've proven that gun control has the opposite effect of that which they say is intended. It sure didn't reduce crime. Crime went up, and it went up drastically once the law had been passed there. So hopefully next year we may get it through the Senate and get rid of the D.C. gun ban altogether.
Well, I really think what's so interesting is the fact that now with the Republicans having 55 people in the Senate, and not all of them are good, but there are a couple of pretty good ones that came on board, aren't there?
Yes, so very definitely.
That may very well be able to negate Dianne Feinstein, Senator Feinstein, who was the ultimate in hypocrites. When she was mayor of San Francisco, she wanted a gun permit so she could protect her life. She just doesn't want you to have a gun to protect your life. She gives hypocrisy a bad name. We're going to be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Larry Pratt, and we're talking about what's going on as far as the legislation is concerned. They weren't able to get the Brady Bill reenacted, so that's really a pretty good situation. My fear was that if they'd gotten it reenacted, George Bush, who certainly distinguished himself when he was the governor of Texas by being pro-gun, when he had already said if the legislation came to his desk, now that he's the president, he would have signed it. Is that right?
He did. His spokesman made that statement on more than one occasion, and so we knew that we definitely had to block the renewal of Feinstein's ban in the Congress, because we didn't have, nobody had the illusion that we had a backstop with the presidential veto. Actually, the president hasn't vetoed anything yet, so whether it's guns or anything else, if you want it stopped, you'd better do it in the Congress, because that's your one and only chance.
Well, of course, you really did pretty well this last year. And of course, for our listeners out there, why, Larry's right on top, Gun Owners of America is right on top of the legislation. And how can people get in touch with you and be kept abreast of what's really going on back there in Washington, D.C., so that they can certainly make the emails and the faxes and the calls that will help to preserve our right to keep and bear arms?
We'd appreciate it if people would. They can do a number of things that don't cost them anything at all. They can go to our website at gunowners.org. They can there see the kind of activity that we've been involved in lately. We have the most recent email alerts right up on the top, and they can see how, in fact, we can talk about one of them in a bit on the national ID card, but if they read that and like what we're saying, they can use our pre-written message, or with a click of the mouse, they can write their own message to send to their representative, so that these folks know that that is not something the American people want. They've not been persuaded one bit that there are any number of reasons that they need that, and the only way they're going to respond is if they hear from the people. So we've tried to make it easy with the information and then with the means of contacting their representatives. And they can go to gunowners.org, and they can sign up there, get on that list for free to get those emails, which come out perhaps a couple of times a week, so it's not like it's going to fill up your inbox. If they can't get on the web, then we do have a toll-free number. We'd love to have them call for information. If they become a paying member, either on the web or after calling the toll-free number, they'll get a newsletter, and they get postcards that add to the impact of their contacting the Congress. They can call
hold that thought right there.
Okay,
this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest this evening is Larry Pratt from Gun Owners of America, and he's been talking about the fact that you can certainly go to their website at gunowners.org, and you can get their information. You can sign up for an email contact, and if there's something going on once or twice a week, you'll get information on the latest legislation going on in Washington, D.C. If there's an important issue, you can go to their website at gunowners.org, and you can actually send an email. They'll have one already written out for you. You just have to address it, send it under your name. Well, the big problem that we have as citizens of America is that we don't know what's going on in Washington, D.C., but Larry Pratt and Gun Owners of America does. And they're right on top of what's going on, and you can depend on their judgment. I've never found any of the issues that they had taken a stand on that I disagreed with. So go to their information, get their information. And, of course, so we don't know what they're doing in Washington, D.C., but believe me, an awful lot of the congressmen and senators don't know how the people feel. All they know is what they read Washington Times and the Washington Post, and neither one of those, well, the Washington Times is a little bit better than the Washington Post, but
right.
Both are, in my estimation, are establishment publications, one conservative, one liberal, but they need to know what you're thinking. And believe me, as Senator Edward Dirksen once said, politicians don't see the light until they feel the heat, and if they know that their constituents really don't want something passed, why they will sometimes have the courage to buck the leadership of Congress, you know, and really what we have is a system ruled not from the bottom up, representing the people, but the special interests at the top, who control the political parties, tell the congressmen how to vote. And the only reason they're going to vote the right way is that they hear from the constituents. Would that be a fair assumption?
Exactly right. It's as if they're in some kind of hermetic, sealed-off environment, and it's just like you say, they respond to whatever they're getting within that environment, be it the national media, the leadership of their party, maybe some inside special interest, and it's only they only deviate from that pattern of action when they hear enough from their own constituents that they realize that in order to be able to come back to the Congress after the next election, they'd better be careful on whatever that issue is where so many of their constituents are clamoring that there be something done or stopped. And then you do see action. Senator Dirksen was telling it straight. If anything, he was telling it about himself. He was like so many others. So it was, when you hear a politician, a typical politician, make an admission against interest, then you really ought to pay some attention to it. It's like, you know, when a bank robber says, I robbed banks and I robbed that one over there, that's probably a believable statement.
Well, I think there's a lot of exciting things going on. I think that the complexion of Congress has changed and changed dramatically. I mean, the Republicans have an overwhelming majority in the House of Representatives. I can remember from 1956, I guess it was, now right up until, 1994, why the Republicans were always in the minority, both in the House and in the Senate. And now the Republicans have a majority in both the House and the Senate, the biggest majority they've had in the Senate of the United States. There are more senators proportionally in the United States Senate, Republican senators, since any time since 1928. Of course, remember what happened in 1929. But be that as it may, there are some of those who are good senators, and of course we can keep them from not listening to the leadership of the party and representing what is good for the people, of why we can perhaps at least slow down this progressive centralization of power, this move towards the surveillance society, this move towards the all-powerful federal state, which seems to be the direction we're heading. Maybe we can slow it down a little bit until we could have an opportunity to educate more people. Would that be a fair assumption, Larry?
I think that's a very realistic assessment of where we are. We did make gains. They were incremental. We haven't died and gone to heaven. We haven't been given a silver bullet. We're still going to see some things happen that we're not going to like. But we do have the opportunity to do just what you said, to stop things that before we could not have stopped. One of the main reasons that we were excited about the election was the elevation to the United States Senate of Dr. Tom Coburn from Oklahoma. Dr. Coburn showed us what he was made of when he was a representative from a district outside of Tulsa, a very rural district, Tulsa, Oklahoma, for 6 years, three terms. He had voluntarily limited his service, and after he reached the end of that time, he kept his word and stepped down. Frankly, I'm sorry he had felt that way, that he was going to step down, but I do admire him for having kept his word. And he was quite happy delivering babies, practicing medicine. He was not ever eager to go to Washington. And one of the things that showed us what he was made of is that when he was a representative, he was obstructing and blocking and exposing so many of the spending programs that were nothing more than buying votes. They certainly weren't constitutional. And he was blowing the whistle on it, and they decided, we got to get rid of this guy. we don't need, if the cockroach is trying to figure out how to turn off the light switch. Because otherwise, when the light's on, they all scurry for cover and they can't eat. So they decided to apply a rule to Coburn that they've come up with for lawyers, saying that lawyers can't practice most kinds of law while they're in the Congress. I think it's probably a bad idea because it means they're dependent strictly on the taxpayer's salary and they have no more independence left them. Be that as it may, that was the rule that had kept lawyers from doing anything except working for the taxpayer. Then they said, well, we're going to apply that rule to you. If you want to go back home and practice medicine and deliver babies over the weekends, that's fine, but you're not going to be a representative. And he said, well, that's fine. I didn't really like being here. Didn't want to come here to begin with, but I am going to make you vote on the record. And they backed down.
In other words, he was going to expose their hypocrisy. Now, yep. I understand, wasn't it Roscoe Bartlett was a dairy farmer?
Yes.
And, of course, he'd go home and milk cows. Why didn't they ever tell him he couldn't milk cows when, you know, he was a member of Congress?
I called his home one time on a weekend, and his wife said, well, I don't think he can come right now. He's out in the barn milking the goats.
Right.
I thought, wow, this is terrific.
That was his, he was a senator, a congressman, wasn't he?
Yeah, still in the Congress from Western Maryland. He's located on a farm near Frederick, Maryland. Probably takes an hour and a half to drive to the district every day. So anyway, Coburn is now in the United States Senate. He was able to filibuster things in the House, and one doesn't think a filibuster in the House, rules are not conducive to that. He figured out how to do it. He led some 135 of his colleagues in efforts to keep spending under control, and was somewhat successful. One of the reasons I lamented his leaving the Congress, just as he was figuring out how to do this really well, he left. But anyway, he's coming back where the rules are a lot easier for a guy like Dr. Coburn to block things. The Senate, I guess, advertised itself as filibusters are us, and he, I think, will be willing to do that, is eager to do that. That's why there was very little financial support coming to him from the lobbyists, the interest groups here in Washington. Normally there's a group that would contribute to a Republican candidate, particularly one who had a fairly decent chance of winning, as he did, but he was very underfunded. It was close to 2-1 against him, and so for him to be able to win was really quite a coup. And one of the things I'd love to tell you, because it just gives you it's actually a good story about a lawyer, and I almost hate to tell it because I don't want people to think that I've all of a sudden decided to say good things about lawyers in general. But this one fellow...
There are some good lawyers out there.
Oh, my goodness, yes. And we know one of them in Oklahoma. he had represented Dr. Coburn in a suit that had been brought against him for malpractice. And included in the suit was a claim that he had built the Medicaid system. And the case was thrown out. The woman that had brought the complaint, the mother actually testified against the woman.
Against her own daughter.
Yeah, against her own daughter. And so years went by, and the campaign this year developed, and charges were made as if that case had never been heard in court, never been thrown out in court. And toward the end of the campaign, an ad was made accusing Coburn of all these terrible things that had already been proven in court of law just simply weren't true. And a week before the election, Coburn had a news conference, and he had retiring Senator Nichols, whose seat he now will be filling, there to help buttress his claims. And they had on tap the attorney that had represented him in that lawsuit in case any questions might come up. Well, questions did not come up, and so the attorney just sat there. And as it turned out, the opponent had a news conference scheduled, and when we get back from the break, let me finish telling the story, because it's really quite remarkable.
All right, fine. Well, we'll get to this in just a moment or two when we get back here. I guess this evening is Larry Pratt for Get Notice of America. Now, we're talking about what's going on in Washington, D.C., the information you're not going to get from Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or certainly Bill O'Reilly. There are good things and bad things that are happening, but at least we have a couple of good people back there. In fact, I suspect we may have more than one good senator now who will represent our interests. You remember, we have a system that's run from the top down. The power brokers certainly have purchased the support of the finest politicians money could buy. We got a couple there that they haven't been able to buy, and let's hope we've got a backup. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and you go ahead and let's sort of hold that story, because we've got about 4 minutes now while a lot of our people are not going to be listening to us. So tell us about some of the other things, and when we get back, when the stations join us, well, they'll tell the rest of that story about the attorney. But is there any legislation coming up right now that people should be concerned about
well, there sure
with the new Congress?
actually even before the new Congress, they're likely to come back the first week, full week of December. And one of the things that's going to be on their plate is a measure in the conference committee, legislation that supposedly would be dealing with the implementation of many of the features of the 9/11 report. Well, something that never was recommended by the 9/11 Commission is in the bill. It's a national ID card. And we think that's a very dangerous idea for gun owners and for citizens in general. It is information that would be made available to a whole host of people that is simply not part of fighting terrorism. Terrorism is actually a concept that's yet to be defined in the law, so it means that an enormous fishing expedition would be possible by many, many people, not even all of whom would necessarily be law enforcement officers. This is one of the email bulletins that we have sent out, and one of the areas where it would still be extremely helpful if people would go to gunowners.org, look up the alert that deals with HR 10, National ID Card, and it'll be real easy to find. It'll be at the top of the page when you go to gunowners.org, and send the, use the link that's there to go to the email that is written to fire off to your member of Congress, so that when they get back, they realize that we're watching, we don't like it, and they can in turn talk to the few of the representatives that are on the conference committee and tell them to knock it off.
And I really think it's a very, very dangerous precedent for a national ID card. Why they want this? Well, we're fighting terrorism, after all. That's the reason we want everything. All these massive expansion of the government programs. Well, if you're really worried about fighting terrorism, why don't you seal the southern border so the terrorists can't come in here? Why don't you allow the airline pilots to have weapons to pretend to protect the cockpit? Why don't you have certainly marshals on every flight, except other than just a handful of flights across the country, to give people the idea that you're really doing something? Why don't we have a defense against missile attacks on our commercial airliners like the Israelis do? And if you're really concerned about this war on terrorism, why haven't there been any other attacks in America since September 11th? Is this really a war on terrorism, or is the war on terrorism being used as a justification to massively expand government control of our lives? And that is my belief, and I think that they want an ID card. I wonder how, if having a national ID card would anyway have prevented the attack that occurred on September 11, 2001. Could you give me 10 reasons why a national ID card would have prevented that attack? And there are no reasons at all. So I really do believe that there are people who have a different agenda, a different worldview. They really do not believe in our Constitution or our federal system. And, we're going to be talking with Larry in just a few moments about this and so many other things as soon as our stations out across America rejoin us here, right here at Radio Liberty. So in just a moment, you'll hear the music. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course in the break we were just talking about one of the things that I think is everybody should be concerned about across America, and that is the effort to have a national ID card to force every state in the union to have a driver's license. It'll be exactly the same, probably with all sorts of biometric identifiers, and this is the way that they're going to get the national ID card in, under the name of fighting terrorism. But as we simply asked, had you had that sort of requirement before September 11th, do you really think that you would have prevented the terrorist attack on America, or are they using the terrorist attack little by little to erode our freedom? Well, that is the background. Larry, you were about to tell us the story of Tom Coburn, and he had held a press conference. He's been accused of Medicare or Medi-Cal fraud. He's been accused of sterilizing women without her permission. The case has been thrown out of court many years ago, but now the opponent, the man who is running for the United States Senate, the Democrat candidate for Senate, is trying to discredit Coburn with its dirty tricks, and he's got a press conference going, about the same time as Tom Coburn's?
Well, interestingly, it was scheduled in the same room right after Coburn finished. Now, Coburn and his crew, as it were, sat down. Senator Nichols, who had come there to help defend Coburn, left the room, but the trial attorney that they brought in to defend, who had earlier defended Coburn against these charges, was there on tap in case there were questions that were asked of him during the Senator Nichols press conference. Well, there weren't, so he just sat there, and I guess he wasn't perhaps even noticed. Carson came in, same room, started to have his news conference.
Now, he's the Democrat candidate for Senate.
I'm sorry, he's the representative who was the Democrat candidate running against Coburn, and he was running an ad which was based on some things that were simply not true about this case. And as he proceeded to go into his presentation and repeat the things, defend the things that were not true, the attorney got extremely angry. Not only did the attorney know these things were not true, this attorney was a big Democrat, is a big Democrat. He's in a law firm where his partner was hoping that the Democrat, Carson, would win the election so he could get appointed to be a federal judge. The attorney, Wayne Hastings, had made the maximum contribution under the law to Representative Coburn for his Senate race. His wife...
No, to Coburn or to Carson?
To Carson.
He had actually contributed to Coburn's opponent.
He had actually contributed to Coburn's opponent, very big Democrat. His wife had done the same. So these people had done everything they could. Well, he's sitting there smoking because he's hearing these things that he knew, Carson knew, were not true.
Because he had already told Carson what had really happened.
He absolutely had told him. And so when Carson was finished speaking, he got up while the media was still there and said, I've got something to tell you. I'm the attorney that defended Coburn, like a dozen years ago. I have told Representative Carson what the truth is, that this patient's own mother testified against her in the trial. It was thrown out by the judge. It was such a baseless case. And he knows that these things are not true. I know he knows them because I told him they were not true. I cannot sit here and listen, even though I am a Democrat and I have contributed to Carson's campaign. Truth is more important than politics, and so I'm standing here now to put the lie to what he just said. Well, that absolutely made sure Carson's campaign never made it across the finish line. That I talked to the campaign manager a couple weeks after the election, and he said, I just want to tell you that I wish I could take credit for having won the election, but I have to give all the praise to God. He said, I couldn't have imagined that that attorney would still be there at that time and hear all these lies and then be willing to rise above his loyalties to the Democrat Party and to this particular candidate and to just cut him to ribbons in front of the media. He said, that was God's doing.
Well, God does work in strange ways, but you know, I think the most interesting thing, Larry, is you don't hear this story out across America. You hear exactly what the controlled media wants you to hear. You turn on television, how often do you see them talking or interviewing John McCain? I mean, we've got 100 senators, and they interview John McCain over and over and over, and Arlen Specter over and over and over. But, of course, somebody like Tom Coburn, the New York Times wouldn't even have the decency to mention that he'd won the election. I mean, it was the most incredible thing. If you read the New York Times and you realize, of course, this is the newspaper of record.
It kind of stuck in their throat.
Well, of course, the thing is that they hate anybody who loves America and is a man of integrity. They have an agenda, the same agenda as the controlled media. But I think you're going to hear about Tom Coburn, who's a real champion for liberty, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, I guess, this evening, Larry Pratt. Our telephone number, if you'd like to give us a call, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-8255. 4684 Liberty, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And of course, we're talking about what's happening as far as gun legislation is concerned. And somebody once said, freedom never close thine eyes and slumber, for thine enemies never sleep. There are those people who know the history of gun confiscation. They know that the Romans certainly had people in the subjugated areas. They couldn't have swords. People know what happened to the Armenians who had their weapons taken away from them in the early 1900s, and then shortly thereafter the Turks came in and massacred them. They know what happened to the people in Russia when the communists came to power and confiscated the weapons, what happened in Germany when Hitler confiscated the weapons, what happened in communist China when Chairman Mao confiscated the weapons, what happened in Rwanda shortly after they confiscated the weapons that disarmed the people and the terrible massacre there in 1994. I mean, this is the history of tyrants, and why do they want to limit access to guns here? Well, you have to see what happens in Washington, D.C. when they take the guns away from the people there and you have the murder capital of the world. They're only disarming the law-abiding citizens because they have a different agenda. I mean, Rosie O'Donnell, says, oh, nobody should have the right to have weapons or guns, and yet her bodyguards apply for weapon permits. When, of course, certainly when Dianne Feinstein talks about how people shouldn't have a right to have guns, but she insisted on a gun permit when she was the mayor of San Francisco, and there was no threat to her at all. The man who'd shot Harvey Milk was in jail. So, you know, but she wanted that security of having a weapon for herself. I mean, what you're really dealing with people who have an entirely different agenda. Disarm the people, you enslave the people, and that's what they really want. There is another agenda out there. Well, Larry, do you think that they're going to be able to get any dramatic new legislation through this coming year?
I don't. I think the Senate is going to be a place where not only will Dr. Coburn be probably the front line of defense, but he's going to have some folks that I think are going to be quite willing to follow him many times when he's willing to take the lead. One senator-elect is David Vitter, a representative from Louisiana. And interestingly, in both the Coburn race and in the Vitter race, the Oklahoma Senate race and the Louisiana Senate race, guns were a big issue. And in the...
Hold that thought right there for just a moment here.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Larry Pratt, Gun Owners of America. We're trying to bring up what really happened in the elections, which you're not hearing about through the controlled media. But of course, we've talked about Tom Coburn, who will be representing the senator now from Oklahoma. And then in Louisiana, why the first Republican senator, I think since Reconstruction days, has been elected.
Reconstruction.
Right. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that race there? Because they were so crooked. I remember when, Woody Jenkins ran in Louisiana, and they did everything. They fixed the vote. And the interesting thing was, even there was no question that it was a fraudulent vote, why the Republicans in Washington, D.C. would not back Woody, because he was an honest-to-goodness conservative. I don't think they wanted him there. But be that as it may, this is another day, another election. So what happened this time?
Well, I think you're right about Woody. He would have been a lot like Dr. Coburn, and politicians like independent thinkers about like the rest of us would like to get a case of AIDS or something of that sort. So anyway, in both the Oklahoma and the Louisiana race, guns was a major issue. In both cases, Coburn was not endorsed by the NRA, but by Gun Owners of America.
NRA would not back Coburn?
Technically, they didn't back anybody in the general, but they did endorse Carson, the Democrat, in the primary, and Carson ended up trying to use that endorsement as a general election endorsement, and so the Coburn campaign, I remember it was a Friday early noon, and I got a call from Senator Inhofe, the other Oklahoma senator. He was somewhere in the state calling from a campaign bus, and he was not a happy camper, because the Carson Democrat campaign had sent out a mailing, as far as we could tell, probably to every voter in the state, saying that Coburn didn't own a gun, Coburn wasn't good on guns, Coburn this, Coburn that, and of course we'd already endorsed them, and they wanted a reiteration of that endorsement, which I gave them, and then I produced a letter which showed why we were supporting Coburn over Carson, both on the record as well as these issues of leadership that we've been talking about through the earlier part of the show. They then got that message out through phone banks and I think even some last-minute mailings that obviously helped staunch the attack that somehow Coburn was not good on guns, which is a very, very tall lie. Anyway, in Louisiana, nobody had been endorsed, and there the difference, actually on the record, was even greater. The Democrat closest to pulling off the victory against David Vitter, the Republican, at best had a C rating, which is what we gave him. And I think to understand Louisiana, we have to explain that they have a, I think it's the only state in the country where the primary is held on the first Tuesday of November when every other state is having a general election. Not only do they have the primary at that time, but the primary is only one ballot. All the Republicans, all the Democrats, all the Socialists, the Constitution Party, everybody's on the same ballot. And the if there's to be a victory in the primary so that there's no general election, one candidate has to get 50 plus 1% of the vote or there will be a runoff. And it was in the runoff where they typically would steal the election from people like Woody Jenkins, because then it was down to one Democrat. The Democrats would coalesce behind the Democrat. The dead would rise, particularly from those above-ground graves in New Orleans where the water level is so high that they literally have to bury people above ground in crypts. And the dead would come to life and vote on election night and produce even narrow victories for the Democrats. But in this case, David Vitter did something that surprised him. First of all, as he did when he ran for the House, several years ago, he would not let anybody get to his right on the gun issue or the pro-life issue. And when there was noise on the part of the Democrat, the leading Democrats campaign, that, oh, he was just as good as David Vitter on the gun issue, again, they requested a letter from us. We produced it showing vote after vote after vote where Vitter was indeed much better than Representative Johns. And he took that to gun shows. He mailed it. We mailed it. It got around the state. It did the job. Well, the amazing thing happened, it looked like from what the polls were showing that he was going to get maybe even 48% of the vote, which would have meant he would have been in a runoff. Then the Democrats would have coalesced, probably behind Representative Johns, and they would have stolen the election for Johns.
That's the way they've always done it in the past. That's why there hasn't been one Republican senator over there going back to Reconstruction days, because they simply cheat.
Well, then Vitter did something that nobody expected, and the Democrats obviously hadn't planned for it, and it would have been hard for them to plan for it anyway. He got 51% of the vote. Oops, no more primary, no runoff, nothing. He's the senator-elect. they couldn't cheat him out of the office.
Well, now, did he get any much in the way of help from the National Republican Party?
He got more help from them. He hadn't been quite as obstreperous on spending issues as Coburn had. Coburn, really, if he had his way, there wouldn't be a whole lot of unconstitutional spending or bureaucrats running around Washington. I got to tell you that if there were too many people like Coburn, the value of my house here in the Washington suburbs would probably plummet, because all the bureaucrats would be leaving town because they'd have to go get a job somewhere. They couldn't get one here because all their agencies would be unfunded because Dr. Coburn had been at work.
Well, yeah,
happily, I don't have any debt, so I might lose some paper value. Believe me, it's a sacrifice I'm willing to make.
Well, I think it's so important for our listeners to know that in this budget they just put out, If you saw that it was about 3 feet high, I mean, I'm talking about three to four feet high, this legislation, nobody's been able to actually read that. I mean, they snuck things in there at the last minute that even the man who was in charge, Representative Instook from Oklahoma, didn't even know these things were in there until somebody mentioned it. Somebody would just stick something into the legislation in the middle of the night, and nobody would know what was there. But there are millions of dollars. There are $15.6 billion of pork. In other words, every congressman gets something for his district so that he will go along with the leaders of Congress and vote the way they want to, will betray his oath to uphold our Constitution, voting for all sorts of unconstitutional bills. But the tragedy is, of course, the money comes back and it's funneled into the hands of people then who will give the congressman more money so he can get reelected. That's the way the system works, and it's total corruption, and unfortunately, almost everybody goes along with it.
And there will be things that are put in there that are even beyond the spending measures, which are very bad. There'll be things that are actual legislation. Of course, they're going to end up costing money too, but there'll be new policy directions, and those also will be unread. It makes me think of the book that we carry at our bookstore that people can get to by going to gunowners.org. And in the bookstore, there's a book that our chairman wrote a number of years ago, and we've reprinted it now. It's available again. It's called, Well, What Makes You Think We Read the Bill?
By H.L. Richardson. I remember reading that 25, 30 years ago.
And it's still as if it were written yesterday. It is the most amazingly fresh book, and it really helps understand what goes on the other side of the closed doors where these decisions are being made, usually by staff, not even by the members of the Congress or the legislatures themselves. By the way, there's one other area of, I think, some excitement. It probably won't have quite the same rules that benefit senators, but a representative was elected from southwest North Carolina, out in the mountains. I believe Asheville is probably in the district and places like that. Representative Patrick McHenry. Now, how's that for a name? Patrick McHenry is a freshman state legislator, state representative, and we got involved in the race when he was in a runoff with a sheriff, and we were convinced that McHenry was the guy to go with. And subsequently, getting acquainted with him and having a report on what he had done, he sounds very much like a Dr. Coburn with a Tar Heel drawl. He had been in the North Carolina House that was divided 67 votes for the Republicans, 67 for the Democrats. They decided they were going to go for a co-sharing. Well, the Republicans chose a rhino to be their speaker, their alternate speaker that would alternate with the Democrats. And Patrick McHenry didn't think that rhinos ought to be given that kind of authority, and so he voted against the Republican package. Well, you can imagine, he was about as popular as the skunk at the garden party. And he chuckled as he was telling me this. He said, actually, I didn't get the worst office in retaliation. One of the guys that voted with me literally got a broom closet. He only had room for a couple of chairs and a coffee table. He didn't even have a desk. And, of course, most politicians would think that's a fate worse than death. McHenry thought it was great fun. And he and his little band of conservative Republicans caused real havoc, not only voting against this rhino Republican and name-only speaker, but voting against their budget-busting budgets and things of that sort. So they were real bad boys, and I thought, my goodness, what a nice thing. North Carolina is sending us somebody to take, belatedly, but to take Tom Coburn's spot now that he's completely left it behind years ago in the House of Representatives. Patrick McHenry is probably going to be a lot like the man who was almost his namesake, I guess, Patrick Henry of Virginia, but he seems to think a lot of the same way, and he doesn't seem to be terribly overwhelmed by what the leadership of his own party is trying to get him to go along with when they're wrong.
And I think that great tragedy is the leadership of the party usually gets their orders from the White House. We're supposed to have a representative government. We don't have a representative government. From the people up, we have a representative government. From the top down, and that, of course, is what tyrannies are made of. Well, let's go to Roger, who's calling us from Pennsylvania. Roger, do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I would like to ask you, Larry, you had ran out of time in another show where you didn't quite get the answer I got to ask on H.R. 10, the intelligence bill with the national ID card features. And my question is, this may be a case study in snow job. That is, I had spent 20 minutes on the phone with my congressional aide there in Foggy Bottom, and he insists that what had been proposed for H.R. 10 had no aspects of a national ID card, but merely forces unconstitutional in its own right, forces the states to require more data or questions answered, which I assume could be lied to before issuing their licenses anyway.
Well, I think the thing is, it is a national ID card. Sure. Every state driver's license will have to adhere to federal requirements. Isn't that right, Larry?
That is the platform that they're going to use for the national ID card. So it starts with that standardized driver's license. It will have the Social Security number, which will then key into however many databases the Attorney General deems should be accessible by that Social Security card or that number, and that driver's license can be used not only by a police officer when he's doing a stop for somebody, say, in a traffic situation, but if the Attorney General deems it so, it can be used by a prospective employer. If you're working in what the Attorney General has deemed an industry important for the national security, well, we can see where this is heading. It won't be too long before maybe any employer want to know, because maybe you're not that fiscally tight a person. Maybe you've run your bank account out a few times, bounced a few checks. We'll keep you out. Or maybe your health is such that you're going to drive our insurance costs up. We don't want to hire you, and they'll have access to your medical records. They used to be private between you and the doctor, but that's already kind of long gone. Wouldn't be a big stretch to include the gun records. People who buy guns get the background check done. That generates a record. There's the potential for putting all kinds of things in there, and it's a carte blanche, a grant of authority to put those databases in, because there's no particular list of what the Attorney General will be limited to.
I think, Roger, you're wasting your time when you're talking to this man. Obviously, he's not telling you the truth.
Well,
remember back in the 1930s, it was 36 when we got our Social Security, and everybody was going to have a number. And the President of the United States assured every American that number, the Social Security number, would never, under any circumstances, ever throughout all time, ever be used for anything other than Social Security. It would be something that was to be private, only for you, only you and the government would know it. Well, they were lying then, and they're lying now. And
yes,
until you
card
understand.
I got back in the 50s had printed on it very clearly not to be used for identification, only for use by the Social Security Administration or something like that. And I thought, boy, that's charming.
Okay, Roger, we're going to have to run. We got another caller. Do you have something quick?
Yeah, well, it strikes me if they're really concerned about such matters as, say, identity theft, then they'd instead pass a law criminalizing retention of Social Security ID numbers, because that's one of the principal collection points for stealing IDs. God bless you all.
Thanks very much. Let's go to Bill calling from Florida. Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Good evening to your guest. Had two quick questions, and I'll take my answers off the air. What can we do to educate our sheriffs as to their duties and responsibilities? And what about the issue of the illegal aliens, where the president wants to make 10 or 15 million of them now legal citizens?
So they can bring in their families and their relatives and their uncles and aunts. Well, first of all, let's take the first question. I think the second question, I don't know whether Larry wants to get into the immigration. That's a little out of his field, but you want to take the first question?
Well, I'd be glad to take a shot at both.
All right.
As far as the sheriff is concerned, sheriffs need to see the traditional, historical, constitutional power arrangement that was divided up by the founders, and that all law enforcement, with four exceptions that I can find that James Madison could find in the Constitution, and we ought to probably give some credence to him because he wrote the Constitution. Everything else belongs to the state level.
Oh, go right ahead.
So when you have a situation like that, to add all these law enforcement duties to the federal government is simply to transgress the very clear idea and understanding that was laid out by the founders. And sheriffs could begin by just getting their mind around that. Then almost, I think, every state of the country makes it clear that the sheriff is a constitutional office. He is the highest law enforcement officer of a county.
Let's look back just a moment here. Okay, this is Dr. Stan, and Larry is saying that the highest officer in any community, law enforcement, is the sheriff. And the Federal Bureau of Investigation was established to investigate. It has no police authority. In fact, initially these people didn't even carry weapons. You know, they were only to be an investigative body. Well, of course, what they really want is a federal police force like they had in other totalitarian societies. So, but actually, can't the sheriff actually supersede the FBI if they want to come into his area? And he says, no way.
There have been sheriffs who have, in one county or another, done that. It not always done the same way. Sometimes a county commission votes that way. In one case in Wyoming, a sheriff won a lawsuit. It was actually, he didn't bring the lawsuit, but the way the lawsuit worked out by the plaintiff who objected to what the IRS had done, the IRS agreed that they would not go into that county again to enforce any orders unless they had first gone to the sheriff's office. And the deal was that the sheriff would give them permission, but they agreed that if they violated the person's civil rights that they were going in to bring an action against, then the sheriff would not only be able to investigate but be able to prosecute. Well, if that were the case in every county across the country, we would find that that was what they call a chilling effect. A lot of federal agents wouldn't want to just go in there and play Rambo if they thought that there might be a guy who's actually elected by the local people looking over his shoulder from Washington. So that, I think, is the kind of thing that can be shown to sheriffs, what has been done in Catron County, New Mexico, Nye County, Nevada. I think this was something like Eagle County. It was way up on the Canadian border in Wyoming.
But then the federal government will come after those sheriffs. They'll start putting up money to run people against them and get them out of office, won't they?
They've tried that, but the, for instance, in Nye County, Nevada, in Nevada, the Wayne Hage is a landowner who has won some significant victories in court against the federal government. Well, the federal government, like you say, they have this attitude. They don't get it. They keep coming as if they never were told anything, never lost a battle in court. And when they were telling Mr. Hage, he was way off his ranch in a town about an hour and a half away, that they were going to come and confiscate some more of his cattle. He called the local sheriff.
Hold that thought for just a moment, Larry. Okay, this is Dr. Stan, and Larry's telling about Wayne Hage, certainly one of my favorite people. He is married to former Representative Helen Sutherland. But Wayne Hage had taken the government to court when they were trying to take away his water rights and his grazing rights. He defeated the government. He proved that they were wrong. And they refused to acknowledge what the courts had held. They were going to violate the laws of our land and take away his cattle. And so what happened then?
Coming back for more, so they found him in town, and they said, well, this is what's going to happen unless you do what we say. So he called the sheriff, and the sheriff talked to these guys, and the sheriff said that he was going to be right on out. He was going to send a deputy out there right away. Wouldn't even going to go himself, and if he found them on Mr. Hage's land, he was going to arrest them for trespass. And they didn't go on. They knew that if somebody actually wanted to call their bluff, then they were toast. And the beauty of what Hage had done, by the way, and I'm sure you've discussed it on other shows, but it's so important. He didn't go through the normal court procedure and argue whether the laws at the federal level had been reasonably applied. He said, oh, you want to take my land? You want to take those water rights? Fine. We're going to take you to the Court of Claims. That's a common law court. There the issue is, have you or have you not taken? If you have, then the only remaining question is, how much is it worth? How much are you going to pay me for what you took? Well, the federal government doesn't like to go that way. They like to claim that all they're doing is regulating. They don't owe you a nickel. And that's why they were so mad at Hage. That's why they wanted to ignore the court ruling, hoping against hope that somehow Hage would finally capitulate. And the beauty is that the sheriff, who's a North Jersey implant, I can just hear it with this, because I grew up in New Jersey myself, I can just hear him telling these guys, if you go out there, I'm going to come out there and arrest you myself for trespass. You don't expect to hear that out in the West. That's not the way people talk. But this guy was for real, and the BLM agents decided that they had more important business somewhere else.
Well, goodbye. We're out of time, Larry. God bless you. Thanks for everything you're doing. Again, the website is gunowners.org, and the telephone number, give it one more time.
888-886-GUNS or 888-886-GUNS.
God bless you. Bye-bye, and thanks so much, Larry.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was Larry Pratt, certainly one of my favorite guests here on Radio Liberty. And Larry, of course, is on the front lines of this battle. You have to understand we're moving towards a dictatorship. We have people in Washington, D.C. who don't respect the law, violate the law, who lie to the American people. They've lied, certainly about why we are in Iraq. They keep telling different stories. The war was planned long before the terrorist attack. In fact, the plan for the attack on Afghanistan was on the president's desk the day before the 9/11 attack. Isn't that a coincidence? Well, if you want to verify the fact that the plan for the war with Iraq was made long before, you need to get our video, Iraq, the Untold Story, and you need to get the syllabus with that, and you'll actually get the documentation from the website of the secret group that controls the Bush presidency, a group known as the Project for the New American Century. Project for the New American Century, the website is newamericancentury.org. You can go to their website, get their information, or better still, get my syllabus, Iraq, the Untold Story. You'll get all of the information there. Understanding that the boys are dying in Iraq today, the boys have already died in Afghanistan, the civilians who've been killed, the Iraqis and Afghans who've been killed, have been killed for far different reasons than you've been allowed to understand. War is a terrible thing, and of course there are going to be terrible, terrible consequences as a result of this war. You've got to get involved, and you've got to join us in this struggle. Are you going to wait until your sons and daughters, grandsons and granddaughters, are drafted, till our cities are in rubble, as the German cities were after the Second World War? Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until Monday, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And, well, we have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because, of course, we have no guest. Well, I guess I should ask you to call in, because our regularly scheduled guest is not available. So I'm going to really take you into the background of so much of what's going on today and how we got to where we are. Now, let me take you back to 1961. It was 1961 or 1962 when a book appeared that was going to change the course of America. It was called The Silent Spring. It was written by Rachel Carson, and it told about this terrible chemical that was being used that was killing the birds and killing the fish and softening the eggshells for birds, and it was killing people and causing cancer and polluting the fields. It was called DDT. Now, by this time, DDT had saved, it's estimated, up to 500 million human lives, because it, of course, had wiped out malaria in most parts of the world, and even in the parts of the United States where malaria had become endemic. It was no longer endemic. We just didn't see malaria here in the United States, and you weren't seeing it in third world countries. But Rachel Carson, as with everything in her book, lied from the very opening pages. She quoted Albert Schweitzer saying, you know, that man is going to eventually to destroy himself, has a capacity to destroy himself. And she took a quotation from Schweitzer's biography, but of course everybody thought she was talking about DDT, or Schweitzer was talking about DDT. He was not. He was actually talking about the use of nuclear weapons. In fact, if you read his biography, you'll find out that he thought DDT was a wonderful, wonderful thing, because, of course, it helped to control what he called the pesky mosquitoes. Well, of course, the science that was quoted in Rachel Carson's book was totally fraudulent. And we have a wonderful treatise by Dr. J. Gordon Edwards, who we were so fortunate to have a number of interviews with. And Dr. Edwards had talked to the various scientists. For instance, you've all heard the story of how DDT caused soft eggshells. Well, the truth of the matter was that the scientists who'd done the study took a number of birds, took the calcium out of the diet and substituted DDT, and you'd never guess what happened. Why, the eggshells were soft. Well, Dr. Edwards talked to the scientists, talked him into repeating the study, which had been reported initially in either Science or Nature magazine. I forgot which one it was, but of course got quite a response to the scientific community. But when they repeated the scientific studies, and they had a regular diet with calcium in it and DDT in addition, lo and behold, the eggshells were perfectly normal. But when the scientists went to the editor that had published the previous magazine, they would not publish his retraction, and that became scientific fact. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and here at Radio Liberty, we're going to be talking this evening about the background of the environmental movement that has brought us to where we are in the world today. And the environmental movement, although well-meaning, and I'm sure many of the people who are environmentalists really do mean very well, they really do not understand the background of what's going on today and how good people are being used in this whole scheme by very, very wicked people. And if the environmentalists realized what was happening, most of them would certainly abandon their false position and join us in this effort to try to preserve Western civilization as we know it. Well, under any circumstances, there were a number of reports that came out about how the pelicans were dying off. Well, the reason the pelicans were decreasing in number is because the scientists went out on one of the islands where they did their nesting, and collected about 70% of the eggs just to look at them and examine them, and you never forget what happened the next year. There weren't that many pelicans. And most of the studies that you've heard about DDT were false. In fact, its relationship to cancer was totally fraudulent, because actually they found out that in the places where people actually worked producing DDT, there was a far lower incidence of cancer than in the general population. DDT actually prevented cancer, and all of this is covered in a wonderful treatise we have by Dr. Edwards, the sort of thing you would never see in the controlled media. Why? Because the whole environmental movement is a byproduct of the controlled media, of the great tax-exempt foundations, of the great corporations, and I'm talking about the oil companies and other great companies which are really behind everything that's going on today. So they finance this environmental movement to create a boogie bear, to manipulate the public, to manipulate government, to bring us into a crisis situation. So we go through the 1960s, and there's this tremendous uproar against it. And, of course, then DDT is outlawed, I believe, 1972, somewhere there by William Ruckelshaus. And, of course, what is the basis of his decision? Well, they appointed a committee, and they investigated DDT for about a year or two. They were competent scientists on the committee. They came to the conclusion that DDT was beneficial, that it never should have been outlawed, and based upon that, why William Ruckelshaus totally ignored the scientific board and outlawed the use of DDT here in the United States. And the real reason it was outlawed was not because it was damaging the environment or was hurting the fish or the birds, but because it was saving so many lives. There really is an agenda that wants to kill off a large part of the world's population, and we'll tell you about the Alexander King's article in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our regularly scheduled guest has not come, so if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but we're talking about the background of the environmental movement and how it was that William Ruckelshaus in the early 1970s passed a government law outlawing DDT, and since then about 100 million people have died unnecessarily because of that decision. Now, we lose about 3 million people a year, and over a 30-year period, 3 times 30, that's about 90 million, 90 to 100 million people have lost their lives unnecessarily because of malaria. Alexander King, who was the co-chairman of the Club of Rome back in 1972, in his biography talked about DDT, and he said, "I didn't oppose DDT because it was harmful. I opposed it because it was saving so many lives." And, of course, this was the real problem, and we have all of the documentation for what I'm telling you. They outlawed DDT because it was saving lives, not because, of course, it was doing any harm. But in 1972, the Club of Rome, which is made up of a group of very wealthy and powerful people, at that time, I believe Maurice Strong was the co-chairman of that, along with Alexander King, and here you find multi-billionaires, and of course there's strong ties into the occult, because after all, Maurice Strong's wife, at least according to an article in West Magazine, is a witch, and Maurice Strong is on the board of directors of the World Future Society. Until we began talking about it, their logo was a circle made up of three sixes. Maurice Strong set up a center in La Boca Grande in Colorado where occultists come from all over the world to celebrate their various mystical qualities, and the witches and the shamans and the occultists and the yogis and the Buddhists, the monks, and they're all there at the La Boca Grande, along with Henry Kissinger and Robert McNamara, at least according to the article we have in West Magazine, and all the occultists get together to practice their, well, whatever they things they sort of practice, but under any circumstances, the Maurice Strong, Alexander King, co-chairman of the Club of Rome in 1972. And at that time, they released a book, a report. It was called The Limits of Growth. And the basic theme of The Limits of Growth was, we're running out of natural resources. We're running out of water. we're running out of oil. We're polluting the air. And, of course, we got to dramatically cut back on the population that is consuming so much. And they used a lot of phony science and a lot of phony facts. But they put this book out, and this then became the basis of the modern-day environmental movement, which is the purpose and the real goal was to destroy Western civilization. And we have their writings from many places where they'll actually talk about that is their goal and their purpose. Well, anyway, of course, it was in 1972 then that the first Earth Summit was held, and, of course, presiding over that was none other than Marie Strong. Well, let's go to Roger calling from Pennsylvania. Roger, you have a question or comment?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Stan. And with an end towards opening up those Alaskan and other oil fields, for example, I'd like to give out two toll-free numbers to the Capitol Hill switchboard. And bear in mind, if you send letters, it takes, some weeks now until it gets through the anthrax sniffing screening. So it's, too late if you send letters. And also, while the folks are grabbing their pencils, didn't Peter Beckman, in his book, The Health Hazards of Not Going Nuclear, also mention DDT as an example, as you cited? And he points out, with nuclear power, when you burn the fossil fuels for electricity, you actually wind up pumping more radioactivity out of the stack, even with scrubbers, than if you actually use nuclear power.
Okay, I'm sure you're... I don't recall that from that book, but do you have those telephone numbers for people?
Yes, the one is 877-762-8762. The second one, 800...
Give the first number again.
Okay. First, it's 877-762-8762. Second one, 800-839-5276. Again, 1-800-839-5276. And don't we have until January, actually, to quash the appointment of the disgusting Arlen Specter to head the Judiciary Committee?
Well, I think you can forget it, Roger. The fix is in. The Bush administration wants him there. They want a man who is pro-choice there. And then, of course, when he won't let any good judges through, they can say, oh, it's Arlen Specter's fault, because everybody will have forgotten that the only reason Arlen Specter was re-elected senator was because the Bush administration intervened in a Republican primary, which they're not supposed to do, and poured money into Arlen Specter's campaign, who is running against a man named Toomey, who is pro-life, who is an honest man, a man without bad connections. He was a true conservative, whereas Arlen Specter is a highly placed Mason. He has been dishonest ever since he was the assistant counsel for the Warren Commission, invented the magic bullet, and has been rewarded ever since then for covering up the truth about the murder of President Kennedy. And he will effectively block the Bush administration's effort to get pro-choice judges in. And then the Bush administration will say, oh, shucks, we just had no idea this was going to happen, but it's not our fault. Hey, thanks so much, Roger.
Well, I'm sure his recent somewhat backpedaling was just a temporary lie. I'm convinced of that.
Well, what would you expect from our inspector? Thanks so very much. And let's go to David Tadashini. And, of course, David, how are you doing tonight?
Good evening, Dr. Stan. I'm sorry for the confusion. I usually don't do this, but my cell phone, for some reason, Verizon doesn't work down here in Long Island, down into my mother's basement apartment. So I had to switch the phone, and she gave me her phone number, she gave me her old phone number, so it...
All right, fine. Well, anyway, you're here, and things are going well. And David is going to be talking a little bit about Vietnam, because he was over there. He's really writing a book on his experiences in Vietnam. And ladies and gentlemen, you can't understand what's happening in the Middle East today unless you understand Vietnam. Vietnam was a make-believe war. We were never allowed to try to win the war. It could have been won at any time simply by bombing the dikes and flooding North Vietnam. It could have been won at any time by simply bombing the hydroelectric plants and wiping out the electricity for North Vietnam. It could have been won at any time by simply blocking the harbor at Haiphong or mining the harbor at Haiphong. And we didn't do that until we'd already agreed to surrender to pull our troops out. Our men were never allowed to win the war. The rules of engagement were designed So the war would go on and on and on, and of course, even then, still, it was difficult to maintain the war. Wars are expensive, so we gave massive subsidies and loans to the Soviet Union so they could provide the weapons to North Vietnam to keep this terrible war going. 1 million South Vietnamese died, 2 million North Vietnamese died, 58,000 American boys either died or were left behind to the tender mercies of the communists, while America was providing massive financial aid to the Russians. During that period, we built the largest truck plant anywhere in the world. We financed it and provided the technology for Russia. We financed the Fiat Motor plant in Russia during those years when they were financing the North Vietnamese for killing our people. Ladies and gentlemen, the Vietnam War was a terrible, terrible tragedy. A terrible tragedy because we never went there to win. A terrible tragedy because it was used as a diversion as our attention was drawn away from America, as God and prayer were taken out of our schools, as our immigration laws were changed to create the problems we have today, as the Great Society, the socialist programs were brought into America, as Congress or the Supreme Court found that a woman had a right to kill the child within her, the right of privacy gave her the right to kill a separate living human being within her. All sorts of terrible things happened, centralization of power in Washington, D.C., and as we watched the flag-draped coffins return from overseas, and the weeping widows and the weeping mothers, why, of course, we lost our freedom here at home. Well, David was over there, and David, tell us your experiences in Vietnam, and did you ever have the feeling of wonder what this was really all about?
Yes, I did, Dr. Stan, and we only realized that when we got there. We, at least speaking for myself, I thought I was going over to fight communism, but when I got there, it was really not about fighting communism. Like I said in the last broadcast that we had on July 2nd.
You're going to have to speak up because we got a real poor connection.
Okay, I said that at the last time we spoke, we spoke about that Vietnam was not really about fighting communism. Vietnam was a diversion. Vietnam was a war to maintain a drug cartel, basically. And I believe that we've got together I've got together with many other vets who had the same type of clearance that I had and were in the same situation. And we have come to the conclusion, although we can't prove it, that the government did have John F. Kennedy assassinated. And the law has an axiom that it uses to deal with evidence, and it says, and I quote, "The danger with the use of circumstantial evidence is that of logical gaps, subjective inferential links of low probability and insufficient degree," end quote. And that comes from a case, People versus Klieg, where some evidence was presented that was purely circumstantial. But sometimes you have to rest in the sufficiency of the evidence. The physical evidence that is available, just on its face, shows you that they're lying about what happened to President Kennedy. Because if you got shot from the back, your face, you know, the ballistics, you cannot violate the law of physics. You cannot legislate the law of physics. If you get shot in the back of the head with a high-powered rifle, your face comes off. If you got shot from the right-hand side, like they said he was shot from the grassy knoll, the left side of your head would come off.
No, the back of the head,
right. Physics. It's
right.
A matter of physics. It that cannot be violated. So you put that together, and you know that scenario that they proposed in the Warren Commission report is just pure baloney. And it's pathetic that the people in the United States do not have studied their physics.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with David talking about Vietnam. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, David Todesini, who's writing a book about his experiences in Vietnam. And, of course, the tragedy is the American people. I don't understand that killing President Kennedy, who did not want to get America involved in a war halfway around the world, of course, once Kennedy was out of the way, then, of course, within a week or two, why President Johnson, the new president, was beginning to commit more and more troops there to Vietnam, and then, of course, comes the phony Bay of Tonkin incident, which did not occur, and if you've read the book, In Love and War by Admiral Stockwell, who was flying over there that day, or listen to the White House tapes, where the Johnson is yelling at McNamara, you told me there was a Gulf of War, there was a Gulf of Tonkin incident, there wasn't one, you lied to me, and of course the Pentagon Papers. It's obvious that the entire reason for our going there was all a lie. We weren't fighting communism because we were funding communism all during that war. This is what the American people find so difficult to believe, that anything could be that totally evil, that we would send boys half the way around the world to fight in a war that we were not really trying to win. And yet I personally talked to the American ambassador to Vietnam at that time, a man named William H. Sullivan, interviewed in 1980 back at Columbia University. He told me he wasn't a military man. He could never understand why we didn't win the war. He told me we could have won the war in 2 months at any time. I talked to General Lewis Walt, four-star Marine general, who told me exactly the same thing. We could have won the war in 2 months. They would just not allow us to win the war. We did not go there to win the war. We went there, of course, to expend an awful lot of lives. So pick up the story from there, David.
Yes, Dr. Stan, and unfortunately we're doing it because we failed to learn from our history. We're doing it all over again. We have people over in Iraq right now who are coming home sick, and they're not being treated by the VA. They're denying that they're sick. They're giving them psych medications and telling them to go see a psychiatrist. And you were right, Dr. Stan, that President Kennedy did not want to get us involved in that war. And I have a quote here from his inaugural address. He says, "We dare not forget that we are the heirs of the first revolution. But let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today at home and around the world. Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bearing any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and success of liberty." January 20th, 1961. And 2 years later, on November 22nd, 1963, he was assassinated, and the cost and the price that he spoke of began to be paid in Vietnam. And that was a real, real tragedy. And doing it all over again, Dr. Stan.
And, of course, Martin Luther King was the hero of the establishment until he, of course, the civil rights legislation got through, and then Martin Luther King began to speak out against the war and said it was wrong, and he had to be eliminated. And then, of course, Bobby Kennedy would probably have been the president in 1968, and, of course, he suspected pretty well who was behind that, and so he had to be eliminated. And so they killed John Kennedy, they killed Martin Luther King, and they killed Bobby Kennedy. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course what I'm saying sounds very, very harsh, perhaps to many people. I'm talking about how they killed President Kennedy, and they killed Martin Luther King because, of course, he opposed the war in Vietnam, just as John Kennedy did, and then they killed Bobby Kennedy in 1968 because he had won the Democrat primary. He would have certainly become the president in 1968. And, of course, the establishment wanted Richard Nixon in there. Richard Nixon would have continued the war. Bobby Kennedy, I believe, would have gotten us out of the war. And that was the last thing they wanted. They needed that war to go on for at least another 4 or 5 or 6 years, to wreak as much havoc as we possibly could on the people of Vietnam and, of course, on our own military forces. And because they expected that the Vietnam War would totally disillusion the military, American military, and effectively destroy its fighting capability. And, of course, amazingly enough, even with all the things that happened, it did not do that. So the tragedy is, if you really doubt that what I'm saying, you try to get hold of the records of the Warren Commission. They're still sealed. President Kennedy was killed 41 years ago, and all of the information that the Warren Commission collected that they didn't publish is still classified and secret. who are we concealing it from? Are we concealing it from Lee Harvey Oswald or from Jack Ruby? Or who is it we don't want to find out? Why do we want to classify all that information? If there's nothing to hide, why are they hiding it? And I would like to suggest that they do not dare let the American people know the truth about the murder of John Kennedy and the coup d'etat that took place at that time, about the truth about the murder, about Martin Luther King, the truth about the murder of Bobby Kennedy. And we have a wonderful video on this. We have information on this from certainly Galen Ross, who's put together great information. We have his book that he wrote on the murder of JFK, RFK, and LMK, and Abraham Lincoln. It's amazing the similarity between all of these murders, and they were murders. They were actually carried out by a well-organized small group that does have an agenda. So pick up the story from there, David.
Yes, Dr. Stan, like I was saying before, there's things that you can manipulate which are, you know, subjective, but you cannot manipulate physics. And when you try to manipulate the laws of physics by telling lies, you're easily exposed. And if the government is not trying to cover this up, which they obviously are, what is it behind this 40-year-old thing that they have to keep it secret? Jackie Kennedy died a long time ago, and there has been more embarrassing things said about politicians than showing autopsy photos. There's something really, really nefarious about this whole thing, and I just can't help to get the feeling that we're operating under a government that is a total apparency. In other words, it appears to be, but it's not. And you look at the election in 2000, and you wonder, why am I pulling this lever? Does my vote really count, or do they make it look like it really counts and put on a big show?
I think we saw this being exemplified in this last week when there was an election in the Ukraine, and we didn't like the outcome of the election, so we demanded, we told the Ukrainians they were going to have somebody else evaluate the vote because we thought it was a rigged vote. I mean, where do we get off telling the Ukrainians who they're going to elect to be president? Maybe they did rig the election. But I'm saying, why are we interfering in elections throughout the world? And I would like to suggest we are putting our people into positions of power. This is exactly what we did in Rhodesia back in the mid-1970s. When the people there voted in, Bishop Mezawe was an honest vote. He was a moderate black man. He had the support of the blacks and the whites. And we said, no, we don't like your outcome. We want another election. We want and of course that brought in Robert Mugabe, a dedicated Marxist, a dedicated communist, who today has killed off hundreds, tens of thousands of the people over there. This is the man we installed, the United States installed. And what people don't understand is we're installing people in governments all throughout the world today. We're financing, or we're keeping Musharraf in power in Pakistan. We're keeping the Saudi monarchy in power in Saudi Arabia, monarchy in place in Kuwait. If we're keeping certainly the Algerian government in power, we're keeping the Turkish government in power. It's a military dictatorship over there with a facade of democracy. American taxpayers don't have any understand. Our money is being used to install Marxist dictators throughout the world. We can't let the American people know that. They might catch on. They might begin to understand what's really going on behind the scenes as we create the best possible enemies that our tax money can buy. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and David, go ahead and pick up the story from there.
Yes, Dr. Stan, the whole thing, it's mind-boggling. This is a typical thing that the CIA does. They put out disinformation to get people confused and people talking about the wrong issues. And there's not only one layer, there's tens or probably dozens of different layers of information that it's all misinformation. It's sort of factual, but they leave things out. And they make you come to your own conclusions. And, of course, when you come to your own conclusions, it's kind of hard to argue with your own conclusion. But you're dealing with false data. You're dealing with manipulated statistics. You're dealing with manipulated data, manipulated facts. And you go around in circles. And we've been going around in circles on the JFK thing. And I think that's the crux of the whole thing. Once we figure out why JFK was assassinated, we will figure out what their real agenda is. And it's not a matter of debate that the government killed President Kennedy, because that's a fact. I believe that's a fact. And there is no way you can convince me, unless the government comes clean with the autopsy photos, that the government didn't, orchestrate that whole thing with John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and then put the blacks against the whites, and it started this whole thing in the 1960s where they had the race riots and people against other people, and they're sitting back there laughing about how they pulled all this off.
Well, they sure did a good job. David, I'm going to have my producer call you back again. We've got a terrible connection. So you hang up, and I'm going to have go ahead, and we'll call you right back, okay?
Okay,
hang up, and we'll be right with you again. Well, our guest this evening is David Tomasini, and David, of course, was in Vietnam. He's writing a book on Vietnam, and it's so important that we understand what happened in Vietnam, because that is the forward to what's going on today. And all we have to ask is, why is so much of the information surrounding the death of an American president still classified today? If there's nothing to conceal, why is the government concealing it? Now, then we can fast forward to September 11th, 2001. And then we can fast forward to the various investigations, the Senate Intelligence or the Senate House Joint Intelligence Committee hearings, and then, of course, the 9-1-1 Commission, and all of that information is still classified. In other words, you and I can't get hold of that information and find out what really happened. Oh, no, we can't release that information. We don't want Osama bin Laden to find out what we knew about him before the 9-1-1 attack. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Let's see if we got a better connection with David. Hi, David. How are you doing?
Yeah, you sound a lot better now.
Okay, go ahead. Okay. Yeah. So you were saying that you are firmly convinced that there was a conspiracy, or that the government, or at least part somebody within the government, I think it's not the whole government, but there is an element within the government that does carry out assassinations. And, of course, you feel that this could only have been accomplished with the help of several departments. I believe the FBI was involved. I believe that the CIA was involved. And, of course, we even have an interview with Madeleine Duncan Brown, who is Lyndon Johnson's mistress, who actually was there the night before the assassination when the whole murder was actually planned. And she was told after that meeting, as Lyndon Johnson whispered in her ear, "After tomorrow, those Kennedys will never bother me again." So it was very clear that they knew on the evening of the 21st of November, 1963, what was going to happen on November 22nd. And it's fascinating if you go into who attended that meeting. But pick up the story from there, David.
Yeah, Dr. Stan, another thing that really bothers me, and nobody has ever mentioned this, and there must have been 100, if there was one, there must have been 100 newsreel cameras, those old type, they didn't have video cameras back then, but they did have those Mickey Mouse 35mm newsreel cameras that they had to bring back to get developed. And those 35mm cameras are high-resolution film. They would have picked up everything that happened. They probably could have caught the bullet in midair if the frame was shot at the right moment. We never saw a single one those newsreel camera footages. I wonder why. How did they suppress all of this? That's a question that has never been answered.
Well, I don't know anything.
Never
about,
even been asked.
I don't know anything about the newsreels, but I do know we carried a book called "The Missing Witnesses," which was the story of about 109 people who knew something or other about the assassination, from Dorothy Kilgallen to the people who saw Lee Harvey Oswald shoot Officer Tibbet, to some of the people at the theater, 109 of them mysteriously died, and I'm sure that doesn't even cover all of them. This did not all die by accident. There was a reason behind it. Why did Jack Ruby go into the Dallas police station and gun down Lee Harvey Oswald when he knew he was going to be shot? Why would a thug, and that's what he was, a man working and associated with the mafia, a small-time crook, why would he gun down the man who was supposed to have assassinated President Kennedy when there was no way Jack Ruby could escape? So there's so much to the story that has never been told. Pick up the story there, David.
Well, that was done because they wanted to eliminate the witness, because he probably had an airtight alibi. If you shoot the main perpetrator, then somebody could come and say, well, he did it, here's the gun, and here's the bullet, and we know he bought the gun through the mail, and the bullet matches the rifle, so they say, but that evidence has never been produced. So it leaves me to make only one conclusion. I have to sit back and rely on the physical evidence. The physical evidence states that you cannot violate the law of physics. And the only person who could have shot President Kennedy from any angle, if you lay it out, model it out, if you shoot from behind and above, his face ends up on the back of the front seat. If you shoot from the right, his left side of his head ends up on his wife's lap. You can't shoot from the front without going through the window. So there's only one other place that the bullet could have come from. And it was briefly mentioned in William Cooper's Behold a Pale Horse. And he alleges that Mr. Greer, the driver who was a member of the ONI and probably hooked up with the CIA, shot him under his right shoulder, Annie Oakley style. And how that could have been done, it's a lot more, believe me, it's a lot more plausible than magic bullets that wait midair for 2 seconds.
Well, of course, there are those who think that the shot was fired from the grassy knoll, and of course, we'll never know the truth of that. There's so many stories that are put out there just to confuse the people. So, you know, was it the grassy knoll? Was it the driver of the car? I've heard that theory. I've never been completely taken with it. But be that as it may, the one thing we can be sure of is that it was not Lee Harvey Oswald. That's why they had to kill Oswald. They could not let the truth come out. Once he was dead, then, of course, they could convince the American people. He got those shots off. Here's a man who, in April, couldn't hit the General Edwin Walker sitting silhouetted in a window, and he was just outside the window with a high-powered rifle. He couldn't hit him, but he was supposed to get 2 shots off to hit the president, and actually 3 shots off in about 5 seconds. No way that could have been done. And certainly if he was such a good shot, why did he miss General Walker, in April of that year? So the story just doesn't hold true. What they were doing, of course, was creating an image of somebody who was pro-communist. He was supposedly associated with the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. He had been to Russia. They were trying to convince us it was a communist assassination of the American president. That, of course, they created all these false stories. The other stories, it was Fidel Castro, or that it was the mafia, or that it was the oil man, or it was the CIA, or there were all these stories that were put out. There was the anti-Castro Cubans who wanted to kill him because of the betrayal of the Bay of Pigs. All these possible explanations designed for one purpose, and that was to confuse the American people.
That's correct, Dr. Stan. Where there's confusion, there's failure to act, because you can't act on speculation. That's the problem. Once you have people speculating, then they get tired of speculating, and they say, oh, well, that was 40 years ago. What does that have to do with what's going on today? And they say the same thing about Vietnam. No, that was 35 years ago, 30 years ago. What bearing does that have on what's happening today? Well, it does have a lot of bearing on what's happening today, because these people have been behind all of this stuff probably since the day that second shot was heard around the world was fired at President Kennedy. And I believe on that day, if not before then, that there has been a shadow government operating in this country.
I believe you're absolutely right. And I think that they have to realize that they planned getting us into this war with Iraq long before the 9/11 attack. The 9/11 attack is used as justification, but it was not the real reason for our going to war.
You know, Dr. Stan, I say this with great trepidation because I really, really love this country, and I put my life on the line for this country. I had one of the highest security clearances that you could get. It was a top-secret crypto clearance. I could sit right next to the president, and I'd be cleared for it. I could become anything I wanted to be in the military. But because of the things that I saw going on, I could not, in good conscience, stay in the service. I had to get out. I just had to. And it's when you put all of this stuff together, the human mind works. It tries to resolve things, and if it can't resolve them, it tries to put them in the background. And that's what post-traumatic stress is all about. It's an irresolvable moral dilemma, and your mind gets tired dealing with this stuff that it can't solve. And it just, in Ecclesiastes it says that in much wisdom there is much grief, and that's where we get the flip side of it. In ignorance there is bliss. You know, a lot of people are very blissful these days. They can't put two and two together and come up with a scenario that says, hey, look, there's something wrong here. Let's try to figure out what it is. They're just content to just let it go and let it go and let it go, and our freedom is going down the tubes.
Well, I think it's such a tragic situation when the American people never question what we're told. We're told, oh, we have to have a Patriot Act, we have to have a national ID card, we've got to have video surveillance of everybody, we've got, of course, have the ability to search people's homes without a warrant because we're involved in war on terrorism. And yet, how many times has this been used to thwart terrorism here in the United States? And why, if we're really, of course, involved with the war on terrorism, has there not been one single major terrorist attack in the United States with all these people throughout the world who hate us? I think we've got the greatest intelligence agencies in the world. Why, within 24 hours of the 9/11 attack, they knew who all of the people were, even though they had no record of them previously at all. They had pictures of all of those people. That is the most amazing information, gathering of information that is possible, unless, of course, they knew who all those people were ahead of time.
That's right, Dr. Stan. And within hours of the JFK assassination, they had picked up Lee Harvey Oswald in the movie theater. How did they know he was there? It's amazing. Now they're claiming incompetence. And Dr. Stan, that's another little diversionary tactic, because it's much better when you're caught with your pants down to claim incompetence than to be accused of treason against your own country.
Well, I think, of course, we know it was not incompetence because nobody was ever fired. Nobody was ever demoted. And nobody, of course, was called and held responsible. We're just told, oh, it was just all a terrible, terrible mistake. And the people, of course, who were in key positions with government that could have done the right thing were promoted, rather than, of course, punished and relieved of their positions of authority. So they were promoted because they did a bad job. No, I think they were promoted because they did a very fine job. They did exactly what they were told to do, and they're getting a lot more money, and they got bonuses. And the fellow we're told at back at FBI headquarters who just couldn't connect the dots, he could connect the dots. They cannot let the American people. Could you imagine what would happen if they were to come forward and say, yeah, we knew the attack was coming, and we decided the best thing to do was not to try to stop that? Why, the American people would be incensed. Because,
right.
You see, they cannot tell the truth. Because but there are people there who have a different set of values. They believe the end justifies the means. They believe we had to go to war in the Middle East. We have to be able to control the oil there. If we cannot control the oil in the Middle East, why, our whole economy will begin to grind down to a halt. Oh, I mean, we need oil to make plastics. We need oil to make gasoline. We need oil for fueling oil. We need it for all sorts of things. Our whole society is based upon the ready availability of petrochemicals. We use them in all sorts of drugs, and we use them in salves, and we use them in making Vaseline. We use it for literally thousands of things we can't get by without an oil we're an oil-based economy. And, well, weren't they justified in allowing this to happen? Wasn't it worth that so we could get into the war over there, so we can control the oil, so we can continue living well? And I would like to say no. The end never justifies the means. And somebody is answerable for the deaths of those 3,000 people. And I do not believe for one minute that our government was so incompetent they did not know what was going to happen that morning. And I know that because I know people who've talked to FBI agents who said, sure, we knew it was going to come down, but we couldn't come forward beforehand and we can't come forward now. Their lives and the lives of their families are in danger. We're talking about here in the United States, not over in Russia. They had gone secretly to David Shippers. They'd gone secretly to our friend Dr. Garth Nicholson. But you see, they cannot let the American people know the truth, and everything is being done to conceal the truth, and anybody who tries to speak out is demonized, or, as in the case of Sybil Edmonds, they put a congressional gag order on her and say, you speak out and you'll go to prison.
That's right, Dr. Stan. You know, the incompetence reminds the promotions because of the incompetence reminds me of a book I read a long time ago. I think the title was it, The Peter Principle, where somebody gets promoted to the level of that he can, is incompetent.
You're going to have to keep speaking up pretty loudly there because we keep fading away. Go ahead.
Okay, I said the promotions of the incompetent people reminds me of a book I read a long time ago. The title of it was The Peter Principle, where somebody is incompetent and is promoted because of his incompetence. I don't know. We have enough oil up in Alaska to last us 500 years, and it doesn't make sense to go over and endanger not only the lives of the soldiers who are over there fighting, but by putting enmity between us and the Saudis and the Iraqis and the Iranians. It doesn't make sense. It does make sense we went into Afghanistan because we had... had signed a contract to bring a pipeline through there and to get the oil from Iraq through Afghanistan to the ports. But to not go after our own resources when they're right here in our own country up in Alaska, it does not make sense.
Well, it does make sense, David. If you realize this is long-range planning, they created this crisis. They blocked the development of nuclear power in plants here in the United States using the excuse, oh, they might explode, or we don't know what to do with the spent fuel cells. And I always point out, what does everybody else in the world do with their spent fuel from a nuclear plant? Why, they reprocess it, but not here in America. Oh, no, we've got all over the United States, we've got the spent fuel, the tanks are beginning to leak. Oh, we're going to contaminate everything. Why don't we simply reprocess it? Why? Because the federal government outlawed it, passed legislation. We can't do it. Every other country in the world reprocesses their spent fuel. Most Americans don't even know this is an alternative because the media doesn't tell them that. And then they block certainly building the pipelines down from Alaska. The pathway is already there to put in another oil line and a natural gas line. And they've specifically not done that to create the crisis to justify the war in the Middle East. This is what people don't understand. This is long-range planning. They know exactly what they're doing. They just want the American people to know.
All right, Dr. Stan, we don't reprocess our fuel rods, but we do recycle them. We grind them up and we use them to make full metal jackets, uranium jackets for bullets that we're shooting all over Iraq, Iran, and Afghanistan, and contaminating that land and our own soldiers who come home with radiation sickness.
Well, actually, of course, that is depleted uranium. That is the byproduct from which they get the uranium-235 they pull on the fuel rods. But the depleted uranium is just solid uranium-238 with a little 235 left over. The depleted part is that they've taken out most of the 235, which you make the fuel rods from. But certainly depleted uranium munitions that we're using over there in Iraq are going to produce terrible, terrible complications down the road. We've talked to enough people who've studied this. I'm fairly convinced, well, of course, Dr. Rocky, who commanded a group of 100 young, healthy people who worked with him, were contaminating military vehicles. And according to Dr. Rocky, 30 of those young, healthy people are now dead out of the 100 that he had. So, but you're not reading about this in the New York Times. We are waging a nuclear war in the Middle East today, and the Arabs know it, and people throughout the world know it. The only people who do not know that we are contaminating all of Iraq with depleted uranium are the American people.
Yes, Dr. Stan, and we also we did also ecological terrorism in Vietnam 35 years ago.
You're talking about Agent Orange.
Agent Orange.
And they lied about that and lied, didn't they?
They knew about that Agent Orange stuff back in the Korean War. And then they sprayed it on us. And then when they stopped using it, I think it was in 1969 or the early part of 1970 when the Department of Defense outlawed it, they had hundreds of barrels of this stuff left over, at least on Tanzanut they did. And so what they did with it is they didn't dispose of it. What they did was they put a 50-gallon drum on the back of a Jeep and got one of those garden-type pump-up sprayers and filled the garden sprayer up with the Agent Orange and the defoliant and sprayed it around the barracks to kill the weeds around the barracks because nobody wanted to mow the weeds around the barracks. And everybody that was over there, even the people who never were out in the field or were on the base, have been exposed to Agent Orange, whether they know it or not. That stuff was everywhere. And triple canopied rainforest that's thousands of years old, how that stuff works is it de-inhibits the gene in the plant that limits the growth. In other words, it's like a super miracle growth. What it does is it makes the plants grow. And it makes them grow so fast that they explode. A tree will literally explode within 12 hours of being exposed to Agent Orange. Imagine what it does to a human body.
Well, I know that certainly I think it was General Sobol, wasn't it, whose son developed leukemia or lymphoma as a result of that and died. And he tried to expose what was going on over there after the war.
Right. If it wasn't... The one who exposed it was a worker who worked for the VA. Her name was Martha Victor. She worked out of the Chicago VA. And she noticed that the guys who were coming back sick, who developed all of these illnesses after so many years, had all one thing in common. They were out in the field and exposed to heavy doses of defoliant. They were involved in Operation Ranch Hand, which is the code name for the defoliant operation that wiped out about 4 million acres of rainforest. And that stuff got into the rice paddies, it got into all the stuff that grew, the vegetables that the U.S. Navy was buying for the Navy sailors on ships got contaminated with it, and it ended up in the galleys on the ships that were offshore. So nowhere that you could be were you immune to being exposed to the stuff. It went 30 miles offshore to Navy ships in the form of vegetables and foodstuffs that were contaminated with Agent Orange, and people ate it. It's amazing.
Well, now, of course, so what finally happened? Eventually, they did admit, and what was it, 30 years later, and they gave these people some small disability?
It was, out of all the people that the lawsuit was filed on behalf of, it was a class action lawsuit against, there was, I think, four plaintiffs.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, David Tottesini, and he was just talking about the lawsuits that resulted from the Agent Orange spraying. And the government lied for years. They knew, of course, in large doses the dioxin could be very dangerous, and they were using very large, excessive doses, very small doses, not going to be a problem, but the very large doses are terribly, terribly toxic. So they lied and they lied and they lied, and then eventually they did give us, there were the class action suits, and what happened, David?
Well, it ended up in the biggest lawsuit in history. I forget how many billions of dollars it was. Up until that point, it was the biggest lawsuit in history, and the one that topped that was the one against the tobacco companies. But up until that point, it was the largest settlement in history.
And of course, did the veterans get any compensation?
Well, I'm in the middle of that right now, in that litigation right now, to get on board of that because I found out too late, it's supposed to be retroactive, and there's papers to be filed, and there's forms to fill out, and it's a big runaround. It's the time that it wastes is not really worth the money that you're going to get, but I'm going to do it on general principles.
All right, fine. Well, I guess this evening has been David Tadashini. We're just talking about Vietnam and, of course, what led up to Vietnam and the assassination of the American president who did not want to get involved in Vietnam. We're out of time, David. Anyway, do you have a parting thought for our listeners?
Yes. I know a lot of people who have been listening to the program. I've been waiting for my book to come out. I have a website. It's www.net4truthusa.com. And they can log on to that website and get a sampler from the book directly from the publisher. And Dr. Stan, they should read your book, the book that you wrote.
Brotherhood of Darkness.
Brotherhood of Darkness, because that is probably the most concise treatise I've ever seen on the whole situation that's going on right now.
Well, you're very kind to say that. Anyway, David, thanks very much for being with us, and keep in touch. I want to see the book when it does get out.
Happy Thanksgiving, Dr. Stan. God bless you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, our guest this evening, David Tadashini, is writing a book on Vietnam, and hopefully it's going to be out here before very long. And then, of course, we'll get to the website. If you want to get in touch with him, just go up on the website and type in David Tadashini, T-O-D-E-S. C-H-I-N-I, that's T-O-D-E-S-C-H-I-N-I, Tadashini, and of course Google will take you right to his website. But it's important that you understand that what Vietnam was all about, a war we never fought to win. It was a great diversion. And of course, as our attention is being fixed on Iraq, we're losing our freedom here at home. They're passing all sorts of draconian laws to gut the very essence of our constitutional freedom. The move towards globalization is continuing, and of course they're transferring our jobs, they're transferring our factories, they're transferring our wealth out of this country. They're intentionally dropping the value of our currency, which is just going to destroy the value of the savings of the middle class. They know exactly what they're doing. They just can't let the American people know. And believe me, it involves the leaders of both political parties, because behind all of this is the Brotherhood of Darkness I write about in my book. If you have not read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, it is available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And you can get the book or the video or the audio tape or get all of them together. We also have an excellent video. It's called Iraq, The Untold Story. It comes with a syllabus. It will give you all the documentation of all the wars of the last century. And they were all fraudulent. They were all fought for entirely different purposes. The ultimate goal was this idea of a world government under the new ruling elite. And, of course, this is these ideas go back to Plato. They certainly go back to Francis Bacon, who sent a group of Rosicrucians to America in 1640 to take over control of our government. You see their emblem on the back of our dollar bill. So if you'd like to get a copy of our latest newsletter, October newsletter tells you the whole story, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and protection. Until Monday, may the Lord be with you.